Support for this podcast comes from the Fletcher School of Global Affairs at Tufts University. To start your future as a global changemaker, you must have context across fields like international business, cybersecurity, energy policy, and more. Don't just study global affairs, shape them. Visit fletcher.tufts.edu. Funding for this podcast comes from MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink software, accelerating the pace of engineering and science. Learn more at mathworks.com.
From NPR and WBUR Boston, I'm Meghna Chakrabarty, and this is On Point. Here's just a couple of things that happened yesterday. The Attorney General broke with norms and reversed previous Justice Department guidance and is now allowing federal prosecutors to investigate allegations of voting irregularity before results are certified by states. The White House press secretary appeared at a Trump campaign event. She claimed she was there as a private citizen because otherwise it would have been in violation of the law. She made new allegations against Pennsylvania's voting system. She had no evidence to offer whatsoever. The Senate Majority Leader, also in a break with Democratic norms, refused to acknowledge Joe Biden as president-elect and instead threw his support behind President Trump's litigation efforts, all of which lack evidence of significant fraud. And President Trump fired the defense secretary. Just hours later, Mark Esper gave an interview to the Military Times where he said, quote, "Who's going to come in behind me? It's going to be a real yes man." And then, God help us. Well, meanwhile, as those events were unfolding here in the United States, in Nairobi, Kenya, political writer Patrick Gathara filed this on Twitter.
Hashtag breaking. After he fires defense minister who refused to deploy army against unarmed protesters, many fear aging U.S. autocrat Donald Trump will declare martial law in the strife-torn, banana-growing republic so as to keep power despite losing last week's presidential election.
Well, Patrick Gathara has been filing these breaking news tweets since just before Election Day, filing them again from Nairobi, as I said. Patrick, could you read another one of your favorite tweets from this long stream of breaking news updates you've been putting out?
Okay. Breaking. The troubled country is split between supporters of incumbent autocrat Donald Trump, primarily members of the white ethnic majority living in the vast rural interior, and a coalition of ethnic minorities and moderate whites, which supports opposition leader Joe Biden.
Wow. So incumbent autocrat, opposition leader, banana-growing republic, strife-torn. There's another one here that I caught my eye out of the dozens that you've been tweeting. Hashtag breaking. The former UK colony, with breathtaking natural beauty and richly endowed with natural resources and friendly people, but also riven by deep ethnic divisions, has suffered a series of political, humanitarian, and economic crises which have killed nearly 250,000 people. Now, given the moment of the particular day that we're in, Patrick, it's hard to tell satire from straight news reporting. So are your tweets satire, Patrick?
First, thanks for having me on the show, Magna. They are satire and they are reporting. It's a mixture of both. And that's kind of the point of the entire tweet thread, is to demonstrate that some of the words and terms and cliches and language that is used when reporting events in what are called third world countries can very easily be turned around and fit first world countries. It's just that you never hear it being done, and you rarely see it being done. So kind of the point of my entire thread was to highlight the fact that the way journalism tends to describe countries and to other them, to portray them as exotic, tends to misrepresent the world and to let people think that there are differences when actually we are more alike than we like to think.
Well, Patrick Uthara is an award-winning political cartoonist and a strategic communications consultant and a columnist as well, who's been published in The Guardian, Al Jazeera, a number of other newspapers. And as I said, he joins us from Nairobi. I'm just going to read another one of your many tweets here. For example, breaking: Africa's top music stars, including Kenya's Ben Gite, if I said that right, announce a concert in Nairobi to raise awareness of suffering children in crisis-wracked U.S. and raise funds for the Adopt an American humanitarian program, which aims to help them earn money through virtual tourism. Patrick, I'll be perfectly honest. Things feel so serious right now in the United States that I dare not laugh. And yet, this is what satire does, though. It forces us to see the truth through a different lens. Go ahead.
It does force us to see truth and uncomfortable truths, but through this medium of humor, which makes it, it makes us more likely to engage with it. It is not as off-putting as if it was sort of said directly in an academic paper, you know. And that's one of the things I enjoy about satire, is by inversing it and playing to people's humor, it means we can laugh together, but we can also think together. We can imagine a new world together, you know, and trying to right some of the wrongs that exist in this one. I think, for example, in the tweet you just mentioned, it's obviously a parody of the whole humanitarian industry, and the fact that regularly we have primarily white celebrities coming to Africa, taking pictures with African kids, you know, in a way that is sort of tends to deny the humanity of Africans, you know, to see them as different, to portray them as different. And so I like people to ask, what if it happened in your place? What if somebody came to your house, walked around your house, picked up your kids, you know, took pictures with them? Would you feel like you were being treated with respect? And if you wouldn't, why would you expect that somebody in another country wouldn't feel the same?
Well, some of the things are actually happening here, right, in the United States now.
Right.
When you write about an ethnically divided, disease-ridden country with a fraught election and the incumbent not willing to accept the outcome of that election.
The authoritarian incumbent.
Yeah. I mean, those things, it may not be exact, as you're pointing to, it may not be the language that we're typically used to having used in describing the United States, but that's all true. It's all happening here now. So how...
Yes, but isn't the question, why don't you hear this language? Why isn't the language used? You know, it's quite liberally used when it's describing countries in Africa. You know, nobody shies away from calling them disease-ridden, poverty-ridden, you know, places. But why don't you hear that same language used when we're talking about the US, about the UK, about France? You know, all these places have tribal ethnic divisions, but they're never described that way. You know, so it's, again, the point of my thread is to get that question asked and to get people to start thinking about what they read. And more importantly, to get journalists to start thinking about the language they use in describing other places. Sorry, I interrupted your question.
No, that's quite all right. I want to hear everything you have to say. How are Kenyans looking at what is happening here in the United States right now?
What happens in the U.S. is always of major interest here in Kenya. And it's not just because Barack Obama had a linkage with Kenya, but it's because of the impact that the U.S. has around the world. You know, it's normally said when the U.S. Coughs, the rest of us get a cold. You know, so there's lots of attention. The newspapers are all reporting about what's going on. It's on our TV screens. And it's a major topic of discussion amongst people online. Kenya has quite a vibrant online community. They call themselves Kenya on Twitter, on social media, and it's really one of the trending topics within Kenya.
Well, I'm just going to read another one of your tweets here. This is from earlier in your thread, Patrick. Breaking. First group of African journalists to make it into the U.S. tribal heartland. Files alarming reports of fearful locals arming themselves as the presidential election approaches. The troubled country already has more guns than people, with a majority held by private citizens. It cuts close to the bone, Patrick.
Yeah, well, first, it is based on a little bit of truth, as all satire is. The U.S. is overrun with guns. It does have more guns than people. And also, you can think of some of the stories we hear about places within the U.S., especially in the central and southern states, where it is dangerous for Black people. So that's kind of drives this idea for me of almost walking into a jungle, you know, in the same way you had Conrad writing about going into the heart of darkness, here in Africa. So what happens when those tropes are now turned around, you know, and we apply them to the West and specifically to the U.S.? You know, you start seeing how they can be made to fit, you know, and it's not, for me, it's not about really excusing the language or saying it's okay for us to talk about the U.S. this way, but it's to show that it can be done, and therefore we need to be thinking when it's done to us, when it's the U.S. reports on us this way, you know, are they not making a disservice or doing a disservice to their readership?
Well, Patrick, stand by here for just a second. We're talking about how the world sees the U.S. election. We'll be back. This is On Point.
Support for the On Point podcast comes from Indeed. If you need to hire, you need Indeed. Indeed is your matching and hiring platform that lets you find candidates fast. Ditch the busy work and use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. And listeners get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/onpoint. That's Indeed.com/onpoint. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed.
This is On Point. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This hour, we are looking at how the world is looking at us, at the United States election. What happened last week, and as election discontent continues on this week, I am joined today by Patrick Gathara. He is an award-winning political cartoonist and a strategic communications consultant and a columnist based out of Nairobi, Kenya. Patrick, just because I want to keep that very provocative mirror of your satire on us, I want us to be brave enough to continue to look in that mirror. Could you read another one of your breaking news tweets here? There's one that you posted a couple of days before Election Day here in the United States. It begins, polls are set to open in 48 hours. Could you read that one?
Hashtag breaking. Polls are set to open in 48 hours across the U.S. as the authoritarian regime of Donald Trump attempts to consolidate its hold over the troubled, oil-rich, nuclear-armed North American nation. Analysts are skeptical the election will end months of political violence.
oil-rich, nuclear-armed, troubled North American nation. That is, in fact, how the rest of the world can see the United States, as we like to see ourselves as that shining city on a hill. Now, we spoke with several people around the world in anticipation of this show. One of them was Ricardo Avila, he's a senior analyst, for El Tiempo, the largest daily newspaper in Colombia. And he told us why Colombia is so invested in the U.S. election.
We have a very strong relation that has, of course, suffered its ups and downs. It goes from foreign investment and trade and human rights and Venezuela and so forth. So, we have been considered sort of Washington's main ally in the region for many years.
And Avila says the recent rhetoric he's been hearing out of the United States, including unsubstantiated claims from the president undermining integrity or trust in the election process, that rhetoric has been troubling.
The problem is that although the U.S. is not the largest democracy in the world, it is the most important. And it was a reference for many countries. So when that reference begins to send confusing messages, to say the least, or questions, or the president questions sort of the transparency of the process, of course, it is a reason for concern.
And he says the impact of this election could last a long time.
Let's say 1 or 2 years from now, Trump, it would be like a bad dream, something that an anomaly that took place and things are back to normal. No, the impression that is arising from this is that things are not going back to normal. I mean, even if Trump disappears from the picture, as they say, you can close some wounds, but the scars are going to be there.
That's Ricardo Avila, senior analyst for El Tiempo, the largest daily newspaper in Colombia. Well, joining us now from Paris is Simon Cooper. He's life and arts columnist for the Financial Times. Simon, welcome to On Point.
Thank you.
How are you seeing what's happening here in the United States? What has election 2020 done for your view of this country?
I mean, the U.S. is not really a reliable ally anymore for Europe, even now under a Biden presidency, in that you have a very large part of the population that will not accept the legitimacy of Joe Biden. There's always a strong chance of the country rebounding to a Trump-like president again. And generally, the U.S. has understandably lost a lot of interest in Europe. We're not a very important region anymore. The future of the U.S. will be played out much more with China. So we are sort of an irrelevance, even post-Trump.
For a couple of generations, at least, if not longer, the United States has, in using language about itself and its position in the rest of the world, like we use the words like shining city on a hill, beacon, North Star, leader, leading by our example. Is that the United States that Europeans see today?
I mean, that was never the United States that, for example, the French or the British saw. It was the United States that many Germans did see for decades after World War II. Germans are very aware that it was the United States that gave them a stable democracy. The United States was kind of the father of German democracy. So I think Germans, not all, but most, more than any other Europeans, very much did see a shining city. For other Europeans, you know, there was a lot of irritation at U.S. self-congratulation. Also, you know, in the 60s and 70s, when U.S. television and Hollywood were kind of dominant cultural forms, there was this fear that we were going to be swept away under American culture, with McDonald's moving in as well, was seen as an emblem of that. So, I mean, there's always been a multitude of different views of the U.S., but I think what is true is that the U.S. has moved further and further away.
You know, you heard some of Patrick's tweets a little earlier in the show. I just wanted to know what you thought about that, Simon. Does even though it's satire, does it sound like a? Would you describe America with those same terms right now?
I mean, I very much understand where Patrick's coming from, because almost anywhere in Africa, the way when Africa at all or any African country gets mentioned in American general discourse, it is as a kind of victim. It is with sympathy. It is in the terms he describes. I think Europeans have a different relationship with the US, which is that the Europeans very much, many of them had this dream of America. There isn't that frustration of kind of being treated as a poor little victim so much, but this dream of America, a country where everything was bigger and better and shinier. And I think actually Europeans have moved to something akin to what Patrick describes, which is a kind of pity for many Americans, not raising funds for charity, although Irish donors did send more than $2 million to the Native American mm-hmm. Choctaw people when they were afflicted by the coronavirus. But this sense that, gosh, Americans, many of them really do have hard lives. They don't have health insurance. The government doesn't protect their jobs during a pandemic. The envy has been replaced by a kind of pity.
Yeah. And by the way, that the story of the Irish people sending the money to the Choctaw Nation, we covered that as well. And there's a fascinating history because tribal members in the 19th century, even in the depths of their suffering and impoverishment, had sent funds to Ireland. And in fact, the Irish people were repaying that kindness just this year.
Yes.
It's fascinating. But Patrick, let me bring you back in here. Respond to what you're hearing Simon say.
I think, you know, for us, I can completely understand what Simon is saying, but from our perspective, the West has been presented almost as a homogeneous unit, mm-hmm. you know, homogeneous unit. So where the differences really between the US and Europe have not been that distinct. So in fact, the reporting, I think, on Africa from Europe sounds pretty much, you know, as it does from the US. And I think that for us, the sorts of things I'm writing about the US are really applicable to countries like the UK. So, for example, I did a very similar thread on Brexit.
Oh, dear.
And the, you know, just in advance of the UK elections last year, you know. And I think it suited and it fit just the same. So I think, for me, it's a global problem with how journalism works, with how societies are taught to look at one another as different rather than to see the commonalities. And even just now, when you described the aid sent by the Native Americans, you know, you talk to them as tribal nations. Mm. You know, in a way, you don't refer to other groups with the U.S. as tribal, you know, and I, for me, I'm really interested in why that distinction, you know, what does it serve, and why have we been taught to consider countries in this way or nations in this way, without thinking that actually the differences we have, you know, are pretty similar, pretty the same, you know, across the board.
Yeah, well, you know, regarding the language that I use when speaking about different groups in the United States, what we try to do here on this show is ask them, because, you know, no, I mean, how should we most accurately refer to you in the context of this conversation? So that's what we aim to do. But I take
right. No, I completely understand that it is. I mean, there are different sort of historical and cultural circumstances in different places. One of the responses to the thread that I was writing on the U.S. was somebody felt that it was insensitive for me to talk of tribal divisions within the U.S. because you've got tribal nations. You know, obviously, the way we have experienced the use of terms like tribe and in Africa might be different from how the Native Americans have. So I completely acknowledge that it might be different, or it might inspire different feelings, yeah, depending on where you are.
Well, let me ask both of you something. because I'm so glad that we're getting perspective from very different parts of the world here. And Patrick, let me just turn to you first. Mm-hmm. Obviously, Africa has been the subject of, and here's where, I mean, I don't know what the right word is to use, colonialism, interference, democratic development, meddling, whatever you want to call it.
All of those.
For centuries. And so there are a whole myriad of complex reasons about why anything goes on in any particular election in an African nation, right? Including just differences amongst people within that particular nation. Now, the reason why I say that is because, given that, how do people look upon what's happening here in the United States? Because our current deep divisions, political, racial divisions, as a nation in the United States, are self-inflicted wounds, right? So for countries in which the United States has looked upon as trying to develop your democracies there, how do you see what happens in a democracy that's 200 years old and is struggling so mightily now?
Well, the first thing I'd say is, when you speak of this being self-inflicted wounds, I mean, trauma, and they really do look like that. You know, as Simon has said, you know, the U.S. sort of setting itself up as a beacon for the rest of the world. We were taught from when I was a young child, you know, to essentially look up to the U.S. as the paragon of democracy, as a country that had it figured out, you know, and all we needed to do was to try and be like them, you know. And it was from all our interactions, you know, I mean, we were brought up watching U.S. soaps, sitcoms, you know, etc. So sort of imbibing U.S. culture and U.S. view of itself, you know. And you would think it might have its flaws, but in general, they know what they're doing. And then on the other extreme, you've got Africa, which was portrayed as the almost the hopeless continent, as the Economist once called us, you know, the people who simply could not seem to get their act together, and were kind of the wards of the developed quote unquote world, you know. And I think these are some of the things that become ingrained in how people view others. It becomes, I mean, during colonialism, one of the big problems that they used to talk about was the detribalized native, you know, the detribalized Africa, that somehow we are so ingrained in tribes that when the concept of nations was brought on, we just couldn't handle it, you know. Yet our research shows, you know, if you read our history and stuff, the tribes we have were created by the colonialists. You know, so there's been lots of meddling. The identities we have now bear very little resemblance to pre-colonial identities, etc. So even for us, it's trying to figure ourselves out, you know, what are the sorts of ways we want to be? How do we want to relate to one another? And it was always, I think, sort of a comfort to think that there is a developed world that we can aspire to be like, a model, if you will, for the rest of us. So what's happening in the U.S. now is kind of taking that away. He's saying that, look, nobody has it figured out. Everybody is in a mess, you know, and you've got to essentially think through. You don't just copy what you're being told.
Yeah.
You know, and that's liberating in one sense, but also in another, it makes the world a profoundly scary place.
Well, Simon, we've got a couple of minutes before I have to take the next break, but how would you respond to Patrick?
I mean, I'd say the whole idea of the shining city on the hill and a beacon to the world should now be reversed. And the U.S. should look at more successful democracies and states and say, well, you know, let's ask what we can learn from you. So the U.S. gave Japan a constitution after the war, which has worked pretty well. And I think now might be the time for the US to ask some Japanese experts to look at revising the constitution. I mean, I live in France, in the Fifth Republic. You know, the French have revised their Republican constitution many times. And the US is still stuck to the 1776 document, the kind of top of the range thinking of 1776. And maybe it's time to have a greater humility to other countries doing things right. New Zealand has a very successful race relations commissioner. Maybe that's an idea.
Wow. And we just have 30 seconds more before we have to take a break here, Simon. What do you think the impact is of that sort of reversal in terms of how the Biden administration will move forward on the international stage?
I mean, I think the Biden administration has to be very aware that it might just be an interim administration before you get another George W. Bush or Donald Trump-style administration. So it has to try and create something that will last beyond it, some kind of alliances that will go beyond this time.
Well, we will actually talk more about exactly that when we come back. I'm speaking today with Simon Cooper and Patrick Gathara about how the world sees the American election and the country now. We'll have more when we come back. This is On Point.
Three decades ago, Sterling Cunio was an angry, violent teenager facing life without parole. Today, he's a celebrated author and a peacemaker. His journey is a window into how violence is perpetuated in this country. But it's also a story about how people change.
There's no better example of a person who's prepared to be released.
And about people changing the system.
We have to reimagine what we're doing, because what we're doing isn't working.
This is Cell Blocks to Mountaintops, a podcast and video series. Subscribe now wherever you get your podcasts.
This is On Point. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. Today, we are getting a sense as to how the world sees the United States election and the country now. I'm joined today by Patrick Gathara. He's with us from Nairobi, Kenya. He's an award-winning political cartoonist, a communications consultant, and a columnist as well. Simon Cooper joins us from Paris, France. He is a life and arts columnist for the Financial Times. And last week, we also spoke with Ambassador Ursula Gatzek, the Polish diplomat and former politician who leads an international, or led an international election observer mission here in the United States. Now, having international observers in the United States for a U.S. election is not unusual. In fact, for the past 9 general and midterm elections, the Organization for Security and Cooperation in Europe has dispatched dozens of observers from across Europe and Central Asia to report on the U.S. elections. Ambassador Gatzek oversaw observers in 30 states and Washington, D.C., where she told us she visited polls herself.
I never observe elections in my own country. It would be impossible. I could not detach myself from the politics of it. So this detachment, this impartiality and this independence, I think is the greatest guarantee of the fact that what is ultimately delivered is truly thorough, impartial, and grounded in international standards, not in any way influenced by somebody's particular political sympathies or animosities.
Now, in a preliminary report released last week, the Organization for Security and Cooperation said that Election Day in the U.S. itself went smoothly, even admirably, given the pandemic. In other words, the machinery itself worked. However, the OSCE report begins with concerns about voter suppression, disinformation campaigns, and court battles over issues like signatures on mail-in ballots.
This was when we had these kind of moving goalposts where somebody was sending in their ballot. They thought that this was complying with the law. By the time it arrived, the law may have changed again. So it did cause a lot of confusion for voters, and it was a nightmare for the election administration because, you know, the rules that they were having to impose were also constantly changing.
More importantly, the OSCE sounded significant alarm over the behavior of President Trump and his efforts to undermine trust in the election outcome.
The very reason that we have been able to do now a ninth observation here in the United States, and internationally we are coming up to 400 election observations and we are welcomed back, is because we do not get into the political melee of the election. So we will leave the political analysis for the political commentators. I'm sure you have more of and enough of those willing to comment from all sides of the political divide. Yeah. However, when we get to the question of undermining the integrity of the election process itself, this is a concern.
That's Ambassador Ursula Gatzek, a Polish diplomat who led an international observer mission to the United States during the election. Now, the OSCE's full report on the elections will be released this winter. Their preliminary findings are linked at onpointradio.org. Patrick, let me turn back to you, because in your Twitter thread, you made a couple of satirical observations about maybe not so much how the election was managed, because on the ground in the United States, it was actually managed very well in polling places and with election officials. But in the count thereafter, and how it was taking a long time. Do you recall some of those tweets?
Well, there's one I do recall that I can read out to you. Hashtag breaking, while many African observers are aghast at the conduct of the U.S. presidential election, others note that by American standards, it was a relatively good election. In a country where gerrymandering and voter suppression are not considered reasons to invalidate elections.
Go ahead.
Yeah, I mean, the point I'm driving is, for a long time, we here in Africa, as I said before, were seen as kind of the stereotypical people who can't run elections, that were a space where elections are constantly being stolen, never credible. But over a period, I think throughout, obviously the stereotype was always an exaggeration, but over a period of time, lots of African countries have invested in technology and systems to make elections much more credible exercises, and we've seen in recent years incumbents lose power, and accept it. In places like Ghana, they ran really good election. They had a really good election, and by that standard, even we look at the U.S. and we wonder, what's going on? Because lots of the changes that were done in to fix elections here were at the instigation of people in the U.S., of the U.S. government, through their advice and through pushing for the adoption of things like technologies or systems, having one single credible voter roll, having an impartial electoral commission, to run the election. But these are things that don't exist in the U.S., And I think part of the problems that you're seeing right now in happening with the U.S. is a result of not having them. So while the U.S. was out there preaching water, it was drinking wine. It has actually incubated an authoritarianism at home while condemning it, across. I mean, if you look at the tweets, for example, by the Secretary of State, Pompeo, on elections in Burma, election in Cote d'Ivoire, you wonder, does he not look at what's happening in his own backyard? So it's I think for us is or at least for me, it seems that the U.S. needs to do what Simon was saying. It needs to introspect more. It needs to turn its gaze not so much at what's happening elsewhere and condemning it, but at what's happening at home and asking how does it fix its own election and its own democracy.
Yeah. Well, Simon, I'm thinking about what Patrick said and then also the preliminary findings that the OSCE was leading with in its reports and in highlighting the destabilizing effect that it has when the president of the United States challenges or cast doubt on election results. And then in addition, we've seen in the past several days, the Republican Party, mostly with a few exceptions, closing ranks around the president. I mentioned at the beginning of the show, the Senate Majority Leader not acknowledging Joe Biden as president-elect, all the actions that Bill Barr, the Justice Department, took yesterday, et cetera, and even thinking back from when the president last week gave a speech that essentially really maligned the U.S. electoral system. In terms of this country being a beacon, is it the wrong kind of beacon now? Are people in Europe wondering whether autocratic regimes in certain countries there will say, well, look, it's acceptable behavior in the United States, so it further empowers us here in Hungary, for example?
I mean, I think what countries like Hungary benefit from is, although the U.S., as Patrick says, has always had enormous problems in its own democracy, it would sometimes intervene to help other countries' democracies. So it would tell a leader who was hanging on to power, it's time to go, you lost the election, etc. And so Hungary doesn't have to worry about a U.S. ambassador putting a lot of pressure on it to become more democratic. So that's one thing that's changed. I mean, you know, what the U.S. shows us, and of course it's the most watched country in the world, not I think any longer because it's the most powerful country in the world, it's probably the second most, but because it operates in the medium of English, so people like Patrick and I can readily understand what's going on there in a way we can't in China. I think what the U.S. shows us is democracy can go into reverse, because I think most of us had bought into this kind of rhetoric that the path of history was towards greater and greater democracy. And we've seen in the last 10 years quite a lot of backsliding. Hungary is an example. Poland could become an example. And the U.S. maybe is an example. So I think we've all started to study our own democracies and think, well, what could go wrong? And Trump has been a very useful stress test in a way for American democracy. If subsequently you put things into law, such as the president has to show his tax returns, there is some kind of official validation for who loses an election. Trump has explored the weak spots of American democracy, of which there turn out to be legion, and that could help you fix those.
Hello?
Patrick, you still there? Patrick? Okay, we're going to try and get him back here. While we do that, Simon, here's a question I'd like to ask you about what, for example, Americans can learn, if I may, from British history itself, because, you know, there was an extended period of time where the United Kingdom was the most powerful country on planet Earth, I'm speaking for quite a distance back. And there to this day, and while that may not be that is not true anymore.
Not true.
Not true. But to this day, there's a pretty persistent contingent or even sort of cultural emotion in the United Kingdom about this, the centrality of Britain on the world stage. And I ask about that because is there a lesson to be drawn there about how hard it is to achieve that authentic introspection that you and Patrick are saying the United States needs to engage in now?
I think that what most British people, the overwhelming majority of British people, accepted from the 60s is they weren't going to be a superpower again, and that was okay. And so, for example, in the 60s, there were some conservatives saying, well, if we lose Kenya, that example was given, it will devastate our economy. You know, so much of what we do depends on importing raw materials from Africa. It turned out Britain lost the empire and the economy only got stronger. It didn't really make a difference. Britain kind of said goodbye to empire almost in a fit of absent-mindedness. And although, of course, you know, there's a kind of hankering for good old times, there's never been a serious desire to, let's say, take back India. And I see the U.S. moving in that same way, that for all the problems of the U.S., the desire to be a superpower does seem to have diminished. And maybe the disaster of the war in Iraq was the death knell for that. And so sort of both Trump and the Democrats have been accepting a more a less powerful global status for the U.S., and I think the example of Britain shows that, you know, yes, there will be some sulking and whining, a little bit of sense of loss. But broadly speaking, you can shed your superpower status and end up happier.
Okay. Now, there's one more thing I want to ask you, because you had mentioned it earlier in the show about how the world sees the Biden administration as possibly just sort of an interim between the Trump administration and the return to a Trump-like administration, perhaps in 4 or 8 years. Now, back in August, we spoke with Harvard professor Stephen Walt about similar long-term implications on U.S. international relations. And here's what he said.
Even if Trump is defeated in November, some of the impulses that drove Trumpism and certainly the deep polarization in our country is going to continue as well. What that means is that countries around the world may look at a Biden administration and they may be eager to cooperate more extensively with the Biden administration, but they're going to be asking themselves, you know, could this happen again, right? Maybe Biden doesn't win in 2024, and the pendulum will simply swing all the way back the other way. And that leads other countries to then start looking for other arrangements that are not as dependent on cooperating with the United States.
So, Simon, just pick up that thought, not as dependent on cooperating with the United States. How real is that feeling in the rest of the world?
I mean, it's very real. Speaking of Europe, Angela Merkel said at some point early in the Trump administration, we're on our own. We have to solve these issues as Europeans. Europe sees a lot of not so much enemies, but unfriendly countries around it. Trump's the US, which may now change, Russia and China. It doesn't see an obvious ally. And, you know, what do we do? None of this is probably going to be a military combat, which means that NATO becomes less and less important. And NATO was the kind of most obvious alliance with the US. That's not what it's going to be about so much anymore. We're looking more at cyber wars, at diplomatic conflicts, at China buying influence in countries like Greece and the Balkans. So how do we cope with that? I mean, you know, Europe has never been a particularly united continent. I think that to some degree, we're easy pickings for the Chinese and Russians. They don't want to invade us. They don't want to subjugate us, but they want to gain influence over us. They want to also, for example, just be our 5G network. And I think Stephen Walt is right. I don't see that the U.S. is a long-term partner in resisting that, although it may be for the next 4 years.
Mm. Well, Patrick, I think we have you back, and we only have about a minute left, unfortunately. But you're speaking to the American people right now. What do you want to tell them about how the world sees this country right now and what we need to be thinking about regarding that view?
Well, what I want them to know is that the world really, for the most part, is rooting for the U.S. We want the U.S. to succeed, you know, but we want the U.S. to be a bit humble in its success. It's to recognize that it is not exceptional in the way it likes to portray itself to the rest of the world. You know, that it can learn. There's lots of lessons to be learned from other countries, as Simon had pointed out, you know, and from countries in Africa. Democracy is something that we are all struggling to make sense of, to make work. There are some things that we've learned to do that we can teach the U.S. just as if there are things it has learned to do that it can teach the rest of the world. So I think some humility in relating to the rest of the world would be most welcome from the U.S.
Well, Patrick Guthara, an award-winning political cartoonist, strategic communications consultant, and columnist as well, with us today from Nairobi. Patrick, it was a great pleasure to have you on the show. Thank you so much.
It was great being here. I really enjoyed it. And thanks for inviting me.
And by the way, we're going to link to Patrick's Twitter thread at onpointradio.org. And Simon Cooper, life and arts columnist for the Financial Times, with us from Paris. Simon, a great pleasure to have you as well. Thank you.
Thank you.
I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is On Point.